Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 411, titled The Bayer Facts, I.G. Farben and the Politics of Murder, being recorded on May 25th of the year 2003. Bayer, by the way, B-A-Y-E-R, is a reference to the Bayer Pharmaceutical Companies, one of the major components of the old I.G. Farben Chemical Company, and the post-war Bormann Organization, and an institution that has a very, very interesting history indeed. Before getting into the substance of the program, WFMU is archiving the For the Records programs on Real Audio. More recent shows streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. The For the Record section of the Spitfire website will contain a detailed annotated article-length description of For the Record program 411 within a week or so of the airing of this program. Now, we're going to get into a discussion of I.G. Farben, its relationship with the Bormann Organization, its post-war history, and Bayer. I thought that before getting into the substance of this and some of the interesting links of Germany Incorporated, I'd give a synoptic overview of the Bormann Organization as an economic entity. As discussed in For the Record Program 99, the Bormann Organization is the aggregate of five of the principal tides of capital flow of the 20th century. For openers, the profits from the vast industrial boom of the United States of the 1920s were reinvested not in American industry, but in basically the heavy industry and financial structures of foreign dictatorships, primarily pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany. That was one of the things that made the Nazi programs of conquest so effective, was basically they were able to capitalize it with the latest technology. Then the corporate structures and the liquid wealth of occupied Europe were looted by the Third Reich. British intelligence puts the sum looted from occupied Europe alone, minus what they got from the former Soviet Union and Greece, at $143 billion, and that's in early 1940s dollars. That sum alone, updated to contemporary terms, would be greater than the U.S. national debt. That sum alone is greater than any concentration of economic power or money power under a single control in human history. Then, and that's not including what they had before, then that wealth was farmed out to the neutral companies, or the corporate fronts in neutral countries, both the IG Farben and 750 corporate fronts set up by Bormann. Then the Germans pled poverty at the end of World War II, and the German industrialists and financiers said that they would go communist if they weren't recapitalized. They were then recapitalized again under the Marshall Plan. Then the wealth in the neutral countries was combined with a tremendous wealth and efficiency of corporate Germany, the German heavy industrial concerns like the ThyssenKrupp firm, the German automobile manufacturers such as Daimler, Chrysler, Volkswagen, etc. And that is what makes the Bormann Organization, really the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, so profound. It is the aggregate of the five of the principal tides of capital flow of the 20th century. Just the amount looted from occupied Europe would make it decisive and greater than any concentration of money power under a private control. By the way, there's a detailed professional biography of Paul Manning available for free in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and I have distilled the meat of the book, The Crime, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, into the file of For the Record Program 305, so people can read about the Bormann Organization and email around that file for free. Now, returning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, we're going to take a look at the influence of I.G. Farben on the post-war European chemical business, France in particular, and this is something that will figure significantly in the discussion later on in the program. Now, George von Schnitzler was one of the top executives with I.G. Farben. We read in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, I.G. Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler of IG Farben, Bormann asked, what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general and to IG in particular? Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG would be so great that despite German defeat, IG in one way or another would regain its position of control of the European chemical and pharmaceutical business. Quote, they will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves, unquote. He further told Bormann, adding that he and other industrialists such as Hermann Röckling do not think much of Hitler's recent declaration of a scorched earth policy for Germany. Destruction of our factories will surely inhibit Germany's recovery in the post-war world. That, by the way, did not happen as per the directions of Martin Bormann. Now, the post-war rebirth of IG Farben and its reorganization into three major multinationals, we read from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and note here the purchase of Cutter Laboratories, the firm that marketed the HIV-infected plasma drug to hemophiliacs in the Third World, even after it was known to be dangerous, that we talked about that in the first part of the program. In the discussion of the post-war reorganization of IG Farben, we read, by 1956, the three major multinationals, Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer, reshaped from the 159 companies within Germany that had comprised IG Farben, were generating record profits for the original 450 major Farben stockholders who had organized themselves into the IG Farben Stockholders Protective Committee in Bonn. The big three went on expanding, tripling capitalization in 1956 from investment funds that poured in from the interlocking companies established in safe haven countries by Martin Bormann and Hermann Schmitz. There was a return more vigorous than ever of the huge, monolithic industrial multinationals that dominated the German economy before and during World War II. Again, this economic continuity here, this corporate continuity, is essential. Each of these three spin-offs from IG Farben today does more business individually than did Farben at its zenith, when its corporate structure covered 93 countries. BASF and Bayer individually boast worldwide sales of nearly $10 billion annually, while Hoechst, now the world's largest chemical company, generated $16.01 billion in worldwide sales in 1980. Each does more business than E.I. DuPont de Nemours with sales of $9.4 billion. By the way, this book was published in 1981. The United States is, of course, the major market, one into which these German corporations continue to pour investment money for both new capital construction and corporate takeovers. BASF and Hoechst have each invested in excess of $1 billion in such expansions, and Chief Executive Herbert Grunewald of Bayer AG has said that they plan a $1 billion expansion in the United States within 5 to 10 years. In Europe, Bayer AG is parent of some 380 subsidiary operations. In the United States, it controls Mobay Chemical, whose annual sales in 1978 of $779.5 million would make it the Bayer Group's most formidable foreign subsidiary. Miles Laboratories, makers of Alka-Seltzer, Camagro, Rhein-Chem, Cutter Laboratories, and Harman Colors are additional Bayer AG interests in this country that Grunewald says he plans to double as part of his American expansion program. Together, these three multinationals assure permanent prosperity for the original 450 Farben stockholders, their banks, and the shadowy shareholders of the Bormann Organization in South America, who guard and vote the Hermann Schmitz Trust Fund through intermediaries at the annual meetings of BASF, Bayer, and Hoechst. More about the Bormann Organization's control of IG Farben in the post-World War II period and its inextricable link with the economic component of the Third Reich on underground. The Bormann Organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America and through stock holdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. And as we've noted in past discussions, one of the major components of the Bormann Group was the Lugano, Switzerland-based ThyssenKrupp firm, from which much of the Bush family's economic largesse has sprung. Also, I would note that Lugano, Switzerland is the epicenter of the Muslim Brotherhood Bank, the former Al-Taqwa organization, and also its closely associated Banco del Gotardo, as we've looked at in various programs such as, for the record, 343, 357, 359, and 387. Now, one of the things that we're going to look at next is a manifestation not only of the Bormann Group or the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, which might be easier for some people to conceptualize. We're going to take a look at what business observers call Germany Incorporated, which is the incestuous link of these giant German industrial firms and the closely related financial firms that help to capitalize them and which in turn derive profit from them. Again, observers refer to this as Germany Incorporated. What we're going to look at in the next two items is a manifestation of Germany Incorporated. Now, I've done a long series of For the Record programs about the German corporate control of American media. Two of the principal focal points of those programs are the Bertelsmann firm and the Vivendi firm in France. Vivendi is descended from the La Compagnie Générale des Eaux, a principal French utility firm. It was diversified into the media later on and became one of the largest media companies in the world. Bertelsmann was the largest manufacturer of books for the Wehrmacht in World War II and manufactured all of the books for the SS. Its head at the time, Heinrich Mohn, was a, quote, honorary, unquote, member of the SS, helped to finance the SS, and in turn, Bertelsmann AG appears to have retained clandestinely some of its character. Its top historian, corporate historian, Dr. Dirk Bavendam, has marketed books, the last of which was republished in 1998, blaming World War II on the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, and Jewish control of the American media, which is certainly an interesting take on world history. Now, in the summer of 2002, due to the tremendous downturns in the capital markets produced by the bursting of the American stock market bubble, the heads of both Bertelsmann and Vivendi were replaced. Now, bear in mind, these are media companies. We're going to take a look at the professional backgrounds of Günter Thielen, who succeeded Thomas Middelhoff as the head of Bertelsmann, which, bear in mind, is 92% controlled by the Bertelsmann Foundation, a private foundation. And we're going to take a look at the professional resume of Jean-René Fourtou, who succeeded Jean-Marie Messier as the head of Vivendi. First, from a German website, Überstep 21, there is the professional resume or a synoptic account of the professional resume of Günter Thielen, last name T-H-I-E-L-E-N, and discussing his vocational stations, we find 1970, different leading positions group of BASF, Ludwigshafen, that is one of the major components, one of the major companies, along with Hoechst and Bayer, that came out of IG Farben. 1976, technical manager, winter resounding refinery at Kassel, that again working for BASF. 1980, chairman of the management, it says Muzzle Moor Belcher, this is an idiomatic translation in Nuremberg, that again working with and for BASF, one of the major companies that came out of IG Farben. Again, this is an illustration of what is called Germany Incorporated. In past discussions of Bertelsmann, I've noted that Reinhard Mohn And this, by the way, from the book Global Dreams, multinational corporations or imperial corporations. And I've forgotten its subtitle, by the way. The book is called Global Dreams. And in that book, there is a discussion of Reinhard Mohn, the son of Heinrich Mohn. He was able to maneuver one of his proteges, Dieter Vogel, into the head position at the Thyssen AG firm. That is interesting as well and indicates the clout of Reinhard Mohn and is yet another example of, at one level, what business observers call Germany Incorporated, and what at another level we have come to understand as the Bormann Organization. Again, I can appreciate that's an arcane reference and sounds frivolous and conspiratorial as anything, but it's very conspiratorial, but it is not at all frivolous. And again, I refer people to, among other programs, or among other descriptions, the professional resume of the late Paul Manning, and to the distilled work of his book, Martin Bormann and Nazi in Exile. The distillate is contained in the description for the Record Program 305. There are numerous program descriptions and real audio files available from WFMU, and you can get the CD-ROMs about this from Spitfire. Now, we're going to turn next, bearing in mind the passage from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that we looked at earlier about George von Schnitzler's ruminations concerning the dependence of the French chemical and pharmaceutical industry and those of Europe in general upon IG Farben. We're going to take a look at the professional resume of Jean-René Fourtou. This is from the Guardian of Monday, July 8th of 2002, and they contained a summation of Jean-René Fourtou's professional resume. Jean-René Fourtou is the man with the unenviable task of rescuing the world's second-largest media group from a group of angry bankers and shareholders. Vivendi Universal has had a tumultuous year, culminating in the resignation of Jean-Marie Messier at the beginning of July. Mr. Fourtou's task is immense. He must restore investor confidence in a sprawling pay TV, telecommunications, internet, music, and film group that has seen its share price plunge 70% in the first 6 months of the year. Skipping down. Mr. Fourtou graduated in 1960 from the École Polytechnique, France's top business school and the training ground for Mr. Messier, and joined management consultancy Bossard, where he was chief executive and chairman between 1972 and 1986. Ron Poulon, the drugs manufacturer, by the way, not mentioned here, but it was a state-owned company that was later privatized, beginning again, Ron Poulon, the drugs manufacturer, recruited Mr. Fourtou as chairman and chief executive in 1986. In 2000, the company merged with Hoechst of Germany to form Aventis, where he was vice chairman. He is firmly entrenched as a member of the old guard of the French business community. As we've looked at in numerous programs and as is discussed in For the Record 305, corporate France was controlled by corporate Germany in the pre-World War II period and, to an even greater extent, during the occupation and the post-war period. And we've looked at that in, among other programs, For the Record Broadcast 372, in the recent face-off between the United States and Britain on the one hand and Germany and France on the other. The French were basically used as the point element, but one should bear in mind that the economic occupation of France never really ended, and that one of the things that one is looking at in that confrontation that I described as Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania is the continued corporate control of corporate France by corporate Germany. That was epitomized not only and the manifestation of Germany Incorporated in the Gunter Thielen, formerly BASF executives, succession to the head of Bertelsmann, and Jean-René Fourtou's succession to the head of Vivendi, and they both have a common history with the member companies of IG Farben. One of the things that we've looked at in For the Record 194 and again in For the Record 276 and 278 is the CDU funding scandal and the complex scandal around the old Leuna facility in the former East Germany. From the Financial Times of Tuesday, April 22nd of 2003, we read the following. Speaking of the CDU funding scandal and its influence on French politicians, this could yet throw light on kickbacks paid by ELF, that's Totofina ELF, over a deal between Mr. Mitterrand and German ex-Chancellor Helmut Kohl to invest in the Leuna refinery in East Germany, an affair which helped to bring Mr. Kohl down. And I would note that the ELF and CDU funding scandal continues to be investigated and is sort of a professional sort of Damocles that continues to be held over the French government. A number of people, including Alfred Sylvain and also Karl-Heinz Schreiber, who has basically sought refuge in Canada, have threatened to spill the beans and to bring down a lot of people in France and Germany. We're going to look at what is called by military historians the Battle of Leuna. This was the bombing of the Leuna synthetic oil facility in Germany during World War II. This is an interesting piece of history because this Leuna refinery was rebuilt by the Soviets in the post-war period and later was the focal point of the maneuvering between the Thyssen firm and Totofina ELF and key political figures in France and Germany. And that's one of the things that led me to speculate that the book The Formula, about the development of a catalyst to make the hydrogenation process more efficient and economically competitive with the oil taken from the ground, that's one of the things that led me to suspect that, in fact, that novel was based on reality. We're going to turn now to an account of the Battle of Leuna. In addition to synthetic fuel, note that the Third Reich's development of an atomic bomb was also centered at the Leuna facility, and that the heavy water development was at the Leuna facility. This is to be borne in mind in terms of looking at the resonance between the past and the present. And again, for people who think this is old, bear in mind or irrelevant. Bear in mind the pivotal CDU funding scandal and its implications for France and Germany. Turning once again to The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borken, we read, May 12, 1944 was a fateful day for Germany and for I.G. Farben. On that day, the United States 8th Air Force sent 935 bombers over Germany to attack its synthetic oil industry. 200 bombers concentrated on IG's Leuna plant alone. This attack marked the beginning of what the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey called the Battle of Leuna, classifying it as, quote, one of the major battles of the war, unquote. The next day, Albert Speer, Reich Minister for Armaments and War Production, toured the wreckage of Leuna with Heinrich Buitenzweig. What he saw convinced him that, quote, the technological war was decided. It meant the end of German armament production, unquote. For Speer, it was the turning point in the war. He immediately flew to Hitler's headquarters at Obersalzburg to report on the extent and meaning of the disaster. Quote, the enemy has struck us at one of our weakest points, unquote, he told the Führer, again quoting, if they persist at this time, we will soon have no fuel production worth mentioning. Our one hope is that the other side has an Air Force general staff as scatterbrained as ours, unquote. Hitler then summoned four of the top fuel experts from IG, including Krauk and Buitenzweig, for a discussion about the consequences of the May 12th air raid. Goering and Speer accompanied them to the meeting. Before the group went in to see Hitler, Speer advised the four fuel experts to tell, quote, the unvarnished truth, unquote. Skipping down. By now, Goering acknowledged the seriousness of the situation after additional bombing raids were conducted on this facility. By now, Goering acknowledged the seriousness of the situation. He promised Krauk and other German fuel experts that a significant part of Germany's new aircraft production would be designated solely to protect the oil plants and would never be diverted to the front. But the Allied invasion of the continent on June 6th forced Goering to renege on that promise. The planes and anti-aircraft guns promised by Goering to protect the oil plants were diverted to meet the more immediate danger. At the end of June, A desperate Speer wrote to Hitler for help. Our aviation gasoline production was badly hit during May and June. The enemy has succeeded in increasing our losses of aviation gasoline up to 90% by June 22nd. Only through speedy recovery of damaged plants has it been possible to regain partly some of the terrible losses. In spite of this, however, aviation gasoline production is completely insufficient at this time. If it's not possible for us to protect these plants, we will be forced to curtail the flow of supplies to the Army in September, which will mean from that time on there will be a terrible bottleneck which may lead to the most tragic consequences. I regret having to inform my Führer of these tragic developments, and I beg you to issue all the necessary orders for this additional protection of these plants. The course of the Battle of Leuna became the gauge for the state of German oil production. By early July of 44, the resourceful IG technicians were able to restore Leuna to 75% operating capacity. However, the 8th Air Force returned on July 7th, again bombing the plant to a halt. 2 days later, the plant started operating again, and by July 19th had reached 53% of capacity. And so the cycle of bombings and reconstruction continued, but the total effect on German fuel production was nothing less than catastrophic. Krauk concluded that the only way fuel installations could be rebuilt after each raid was to cannibalize other installations. Under this plan to prevent the total cessation of oil production, Germany's productive capacity diminished with each recuperation. By September, oil production had dropped to 15%, a condition from which Germany was never to recover. The intensive bombing of Leuna led to a curious confrontation between Beutefisch, who was in charge of Leuna, and Paul Hartek, a leading nuclear scientist working on Germany's atomic bomb project. By the way, this was under the auspices of Degussa, also closely linked to IG Farben, and it was people such as Gernot Zippe and his protege Karl-Heinz Schaub and the post-war Degussa firm that helped to equip Saddam Hussein with some of his nascent nuclear capability, as discussed in For the Record 395. Continuing. Part of Leuna was devoted to the manufacture of heavy water, a necessary component of atomic energy. After the first bombs fell on Leuna, Beutefisch informed Hartek that the heavy water installation must be abandoned. He claimed that the massive bombing could not have been aimed at fuel production, since there was a gentleman's agreement, unquote, between heavy industry in Germany and abroad that IG's synthetic gasoline plants would not be bombed. The only explanation for the raids against Leuna, therefore, was the heavy water facility. So again, the resonance between the past and the present, the corporate connections to the German heavy industrial nexus, including IG Farben and the Bormann Group, front and center, and resonating forward to the present and the arming of Saddam Hussein, among other things. WFMU archiving the For the Record shows, recent shows streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available at a longer URL linked to both that web address and to www.spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated article-length description of For the Record program 411 within a week or so of the airing of this program. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 411, The Bayer Facts, IG Farben and the Politics of Murder, being recorded on May 25th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.